off. These white people were wearing button downs and polos and baseball caps. And I began to weep, knowing that it was quite possible that some of the people who were marching with these torches, shouting blood and soil, shouting, "You will not replace us," a ludicrous notion of white fear that has been strengthened and emboldened by an administration that is filled with hateful rhetoric. We now have a president who will not even declare, will not even denounce white supremacy right out. It is unconscionable.
We just have 30 seconds, Reverend Cornell West.
It is very clear that Brother Donald Trump has neo-fascist sensibilities. His failure to condemn white supremacy and domestic terrorism means that he's complicitous in effect and consequence. But it's very important to keep in mind that even under Barack Obama, as brilliant as he was, he was still a ruler of big money, massive militarism. The racism coming at him was vicious, but the inequality, the inability to speak to the issues of class makes it easier for right-wing populism, neo-fascism to flow. We've got to be critical of the system.
Part two of our conversation online at democracynow.org. Dr. Cornell West, Reverend Tracy Blackman, Jarlene Schmidt. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of National Health Center Week Health Fair Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center in Hillsboro. Neighborhood Health Center is a community health center serving residents in Washington and Clackamas counties. The health fair is a collaborative effort to offer health care, education, and support for residents in need and showcase the value for community health centers and their partners. There will be blood pressure checks, glucose testing, dental screenings, as well as information about emergency preparedness, health care, and more. Again, that's the National Health Center Week Health Fair, Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center, 18650 Northwest Cornell Road in Hillsboro. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite community radio station, KBOO. Again, that's KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th from noon to 6 at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, the time is 5:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Coming up next is the evening news. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Yeon Managed Storage, offering storage for home or business, short-term or long-term, in any size from a closet to a garage. Yeon Managed Storage is located at 3055 Northwest Yeon Avenue in Portland. More info and reservations at 503-827-3900 and at yeonministorage.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have an update on the attack on counter-demonstrators at Saturday's right-wing rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Portland Stands United Against Hate held a vigil and speak out on Sunday in solidarity with the Charlottesville victims. Another rally is planned for this Friday.
And on tonight's in-depth report, we speak with ACLU of Oregon's Policy Director Kimberly McCullough about racial profiling in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 14th, 2017. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. The woman killed on Saturday at the so-called Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, has been identified as Heather Heyer, a paralegal who lived in Charlottesville, Virginia. She was killed and 19 others were seriously injured when a car plowed into a crowd of counter-demonstrators who were demonstrating against the white supremacists. Jason Alex Fields Jr., a 20-year-old from Ohio, was arrested for the attack later that day. Fields was arraigned this morning at Charlottesville General District Court on charges of suspicion of second-degree murder, malicious wounding, and failure to stop in an accident that resulted in death. He was denied bail. Various media outlets are reporting that Fields has a history of racist, fascist, and pro-Nazi politics. Fields claimed that he could not afford an attorney, so one had to be appointed for him. The local public defender's office could not represent Fields because a member of that office is related to one of the victims of Sunday's attack, so the court appointed Charles L. Buddy Weber as his attorney. Weber is the chair on the Charlottesville Republican Party and was one of the plaintiffs in a suit to prevent removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from the Charlottesville City Park where Saturday's racist rally took place.
Numerous members of Congress and other officials joined in condemning Saturday's racist attack and in calling out Nazis and other violent right-wing extremists. Many also expressed their disappointment and even outrage at the slow, lackluster response from the current president and his attorney general. Even Senator Orrin Hatch, the arch-conservative Republican from Utah, tweeted on Saturday that, quote, "We should call evil by its name. My brother didn't give his life fighting Hitler for Nazi ideas to go unchallenged here at home," unquote. Earlier today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that the Justice Department would be filing charges over the attack. On a network morning news program, Sessions said, quote, "You can be sure we will charge and advance the investigation towards the most serious charges that can be brought, because this is an unequivocally unacceptable and evil attack that cannot be accepted in America," end quote. Numerous social justice and civil rights organizations have also been speaking out. This afternoon, KBOO News participated in a news teleconference held by the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law. Following our comments from that call by Charlottesville Deputy Mayor Wes Bellamy, Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Yvonne Espinoza Madrigal, President of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice.
I just want to let you all know that Charlottesville, this community, we aren't going to hide. We are not in a sense of being sad. We're not going to pluck our tails or just kind of cower. We are not going to allow these white supremacists nor these cowards to come into our community and define us or tell our story. One of the more ironic parts of everything that was taking place on Saturday was even during the melee, less than a mile away, there were a group of young men who had about 150, 200 book bags and school supplies handing out to young people in the community. They had music, food, and probably about 300 people there. And I think that speaks to Charlottesville. Even in the midst of adversity, we take care of our own. And that's what we're going to continue to do. We're having a community meeting at the African American Heritage Center tonight. We're planning a couple of other things, which I'm not at liberty to speak about at the moment. But we have several different community events planned. We will become stronger from this. I think we've already done so. And our community, again, is one of the most resilient communities I've ever seen. This is a place that I love with absolutely every ounce of fiber in my body. A place that even in my darkest times, in times when I didn't even really know what I was going to do, a community that helped me grow up, helped me mature, show me a lot of different things, encouraged me to continue to push forward. So I take it very personal when I hear the lack of comments from 45, as well as just some of the things that I've been seeing people say about the city of Charlottesville. We're a resilient place, a strong place, and we're going to be all right. I can assure you that.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. This afternoon, the president issued a statement where he finally squarely referenced the white supremacists and alt-right forces behind the Charlottesville tragedy. The president's statement is 2 days late and a dollar short. It should not take 2 days and a national tragedy for the president to take action and disavow white supremacists. When it comes to the safety and security of our communities, too many of which now feel targeted by hate-fueled protesters, 2 days is simply too late. Moreover, the president's Twitter attack on Kenneth Frazier, president and CEO of Merck, make it hard to accept his statements today as a genuine disavowal of racial violence. Frazier resigned from his post on the President's American Manufacturing Council to take a stand against intolerance and extremism. What Kenneth Frazier's actions demonstrate is that hate is not normal, and all Americans, including corporate leaders, have an obligation to take action to speak out against hate. Despite his statement today, President Trump has pursued the advancement of policies that promote the marginalization of minority communities, which have emboldened the very white nationalists who descended on Charlottesville this weekend. Specifically, this administration's Muslim ban, the reigniting of a war on drugs, plans to expel transgender people from the military, the proposed elimination of funding for reproductive health services, the appointment of a federal judge with ties to white supremacy, all make clear that African Americans, Latinos, women, Muslim, and other marginalized groups are not able to turn to this federal government to vindicate their rights. Instead, the president relies on the counsel of Steve Bannon, who has described Breitbart, his former home, as, quote, the platform for the alt-right. The alt-right now knows they have a friend in the White House. It's time for this administration to purge individuals from its ranks who have been polarizing and racially divisive forces, who inspired the ugly violence that ensued this weekend in Charlottesville. Our country is stronger when people of all backgrounds are welcome in their own communities and treated with respect and dignity. I want to acknowledge the statements made by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that recognize white supremacy and credit the Attorney General for opening a federal civil rights investigation into the Charlottesville matter. We will be looking for the Justice Department to conduct a full investigation into this incident to determine the full scope of James Fields' activities. Did he act alone? Who financed his trip from Ohio to Virginia? Did he arrive in Virginia with the intention of killing or harming African Americans? Do his acts rise to the level of an act of domestic terrorism? The Justice Department has unique tools and expertise in its arsenal to investigate this heinous crime. A federal investigation also sends a strong message to the alt-right and white supremacist movement that the federal government will hold them accountable for their unlawful actions.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ivan Espinosa. I'm the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice in Boston. Charlottesville was first. Boston is next. Immediately after the racial violence in Charlottesville, flyers were circulated via social media announcing a rally in the Boston Common for this coming Saturday, August 19. The Boston rally is slated to feature several of the same speakers and the same influencers as the Charlottesville rally. If these back-to-back rallies are any indication, this threat is metastasizing. We spent all weekend providing legal backup and support to community-based groups in Boston. This morning, we sent a letter to city and state officials on behalf of a broad coalition representing diverse residents, including racial, ethnic, linguistic, and religious minorities, urging that the proposed rally should not move forward until Boston has enough time to develop a comprehensive public safety and emergency response plan. Our message is simple. Charlottesville teaches us that we need at least a public safety plan, and that we need to communicate that safety plan to the general public. We cannot be the next Charlottesville. In Boston and local communities across the country, well-intended people are distancing themselves, saying that what happened in Charlottesville cannot happen outside of the South. But even in progressive Massachusetts, we have experienced the fourth highest spike in hate crimes in the country. Since our busing crisis at the height of the desegregation and civil rights movement, we have seen racial violence in our own backyard, making the public safety and emergency response plan that we are calling for in Boston all the more urgent. I will close by saying that in the absence of federal leadership and oversight, we urge all communities to push for local and state solutions to these pressing civil rights and hate crime problems.
That again was from a news conference earlier today. Participants included Charlottesville Deputy Mayor Wes Bellamy, Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Yvonne Espinoza Madrigal, President of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice.
As we mentioned, one woman, Heather Heyer, was killed and 19 others injured on Saturday at a Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. In addition, two Virginia State Police troopers, Jake Cullen and Burke Bates, were killed when their helicopter crashed while assisting security forces at the rally. To stand in solidarity with the victims and voice their opposition to white supremacists, hundreds of people gathered at a vigil held in front of Portland City Hall yesterday evening. The Portland Solidarity with Charlottesville event was hosted by the organization Portland Stands United Against Hate and included speakers from a large number of local and national groups. The peaceful vigil ran about 3 hours from 5 to 8 p.m. and drew about 300 participants, according to organizers. To find out more, KBOO's Doug McVeigh spoke with Jamie Partridge of Portland Stands United Against Hate.
My name's Jamie Partridge, and I'm an organizer with Portland Stands United Against Hate.
Jamie, Portland Stands United Against Hate had an event on Sunday. Could you tell us about it?
Yes, it was a quickly organized, less than 24 hours organized in response to the horrific event in Charlottesville, Virginia, where KKK and Nazis were marching to defend a Confederate monument, and one of their members weaponized a car, which they drove into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one and injuring dozens. And this was a deeply felt attack on all of us who are against racism and this kind of white nationalist mobilizations. Our rally vigil and speak out on Sunday evening at City Hall drew about 500 or 600 people, and was one of many that were held, hundreds across the country, and many in Oregon, actually.
So you have another event coming up, or another demonstration coming up on Friday, is that right?
Well, it's being organized by Portland's Resistance, which is a different organization, but and may draw a different set of people. But I expect we will be publicizing that. Our organization, Portland Stands United Against Hate, is a coalition of about 72 organizations that came together initially in response to a white nationalist grouping in. Here in the Portland area called Patriot Prayer, who was mobilizing following the horrific murders on the Max by a white supremacist. And we will be supporting and encouraging people to show up for this event on Friday, which is actually being called Eclipse Hate. And people are gathering at 5:30 at the Salmon Street Fountain, which is on the waterfront at the where Salmon Street connects with the waterfront, and it will be in solidarity with the people of Charlottesville, as was our vigil and speak out yesterday.
I am curious, going back to yesterday's vigil, did any of our local right-wing fascists dare to show their faces?
Not really. I mean, there were one or two who were kind of lurking about on the outskirts, but we had a peacekeeping team, and they didn't come anywhere near us. So it was a peaceful but uplifting vigil and speak out, which was intended to for people to express their horror with the rise of this violent movement, but also to deepen our commitment to resist.
Terrific. Jamie, do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners? Again, I've been speaking with Jamie Partridge with Portland Stands United Against Hate.
Yeah, we're facing another mobilization by the Patriot Prayer on September 10th, which is a Sunday in about 3.5 weeks, or almost 4 weeks, in which they are bringing a Confederate monument defender, Billy Sessions, who was involved with street fighting, defending the Jefferson Davis monument in New Orleans a few months back, who's coming to bring, as they're calling their rally at, again, the Salmon Street Fountain, Portland Freedom March Southern Edition. So the Rebbe Boys, the House South Will Rise Again, take our country back, meaning the Confederacy. Folks are coming to the Northwest to encourage those white nationalists up here who undoubtedly are trying to establish a white homeland again. So it's a serious development in the merging of these movements, the Confederate Monument Defenders and the Proud Boys of the Northwest. And we are planning a response, hopefully a massive mobilization, and folks should stay tuned. They can connect with us on our Facebook page, which is currently the Vigil and Speak Out in solidarity with Portland, solidarity with Charlottesville.
Well, terrific. Jamie, thank you so much for your time and all your hard work.
Thank you.
Again, folks, we've been speaking with Jamie Partridge with Portland Stands United Against Hate. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
On Friday, August 18th, Portland's Resistance is holding a nonviolent rally and march in solidarity with the community of Charlottesville, Virginia, after last week's incredible tragedies. The rally will begin at the Salmon Street Fountain at 1020 Southwest NATO Parkway in Portland from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The event will host speakers, collaborative banner making, and strong shows of community in the wake of last weekend's bloody Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville that ended with 3 dead and several wounded. The Unite the Right event was partly in response to the city of Charlottesville's decision to remove the Confederate-themed statues of Robert Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Local Charlottesville residents, the Charlottesville Monument Fund, and the Sons of Confederate Veterans sued the city, claiming that removing the statues erased American history. The decisions were placed under a 6-month injunction by Judge Richard Moore, who has refused to make a ruling in regards to the Stonewall Jackson statue. Charlottesville and Portland share many histories. One of which is the story of well-known explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, whose travels took them through Charlottesville on their way to the Pacific Northwest via the Missouri River to the Pacific Ocean. A controversial statue of Lewis, Clark, and their beloved guide Sacagawea sits in Charlottesville. Sacagawea is depicted cowering in a crouched position, with arms folded towards her body and her face looking down behind the explorers. The statue has been on the list of statues to remove or update by locally concerned citizens since 2016. Portland Resistance's goals for the rally are to stand against the rise of fascism and empower marginalized communities. For information about the Eclipse Hate Rally, visit their Facebook event page at facebook.com/portlandresistance.
The city of Portland is threatening to rescind its official recognition of the Overlook Neighborhood Association after the association proposed new bylaws that would exclude homeless persons from joining the organization. The Overlook Neighborhood is located in North Portland on the east bank of the Willamette River near Swan Island. It's one of 95 neighborhood associations that are officially recognized and partly funded by the city of Portland. Tomorrow night, the Overlook Neighborhood Association is set to discuss new bylaws that would require people to have a valid address to join the group, which would preclude homeless people from participating. The city of Portland has ruled that people only have to live in the neighborhood to be eligible, regardless of whether or not they reside at a legal residence. That meeting set for tomorrow night, Tuesday, August 14th at 6:30 p.m. at the Trillium Charter School located at 5420 North Interstate.
In an attempt to overturn Portland's tenant protection laws, two local landlords have filed an appeal against the Multnomah County Circuit Court ruling that found the laws to be constitutional. On July 14th, a Multnomah County judge ruled that the tenant protection laws enacted by the city of Portland last year did not violate the state's statutes against rent control. The new laws require that landlords pay up to 3 months' rent to help with relocation costs if they evict a tenant through no cause or increase rents by more than 10%.
KBOO would like to congratulate Stephen and Lisa Hanks on a slam-dunk success at this year's Albina Jazz Festival. The event, held over the weekend at the Stingray Cafe, was sponsored by KBOO, Shift, and Portland Pioneers of Color Walking Tours, and featured acts including the Christopher Brown Quartet, the Joe Manis Quartet, Ron Steen, and the legendary Lloyd Allen. The festival is also a labor of love. You might not know this, but the Albina area in Portland used to be home to a bustling jazz scene back in the 1940s. Many black musicians had migrated to Portland seeking employment opportunities due to the outbreak of World War II. The musicians would perform and then sleep at neighborhood houses in the Albina district because people of color were barred from staying in Portland hotels, even famous acts such as Sammy Davis Jr. The next few decades would see the Albina area change forever when close to 2,000 people lost their homes due to the construction of I-5 and the Memorial Coliseum. Several jazz clubs were bulldozed as well. But Stephen and Lisa Hanks are hoping to preserve the heritage of Albina and bring back some of its former glory. For more information on the Albina Jazz Festival and its history, please visit Albina Jazz Festival, all one word, albinajazzfestival.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned immediately following this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6 o'clock, it's Labor Radio, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: increasing clouds with a low around 53. North-northwest winds 5 to 7 miles an hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 77. Today in history, in 1935, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law, and in 1997, right-wing domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh was sentenced to death for carrying out the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, in which 168 people were killed. The quote of the day is from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who wrote, "We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our good friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Labor has come out strongly in condemnation of violence spawned by far-right white supremacist groups over the weekend. Alt-right white nationalists marched on the University of Virginia in Charlottesville Saturday to protest the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. After Virginia declared a state of emergency, canceling the rally, a white nationalist from Ohio used his car to attack crowds of anti-fascist counter-protesters. Activists activist Heather Heyer, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, was killed in the attack. 19 others were injured, 5 of them critically. Gina Meglianico of the Virginia AFL-CIO denounced both the racism of the alt-right and violence towards peaceful counter-protesters.
The working people of Virginia certainly do not and will not stand for this sort of discrimination and hate in our communities. Yesterday's display of beliefs from the alt-right was a disgrace to the citizens of the Commonwealth and all that we stand for. Virginia's working families have fought long and hard to overcome the discriminatory policies of our past and to create an environment of inclusion and fairness in workplaces across the Commonwealth. Certainly, we will continue to devote every ounce of our abilities to ensure that rights and safety of all Virginians are preserved.
Despite Saturday's violence, white nationalists went ahead with a pro-Trump freedom rally in Seattle on Sunday, leading to clashes between police and anti-fascist counter-demonstrators. National Nurses United, with many of its members involved in protests against racism, criticized President Donald Trump for failing to condemn racial hatred, while characterizing Saturday's tragedy as the product of violence on many sides. NNU spokesperson Chuck Idelson.
You can't help but notice the original statements that came out of the White House trying to equate the racism and the violence from the white supremacists with people who are protesting in response to that. There is no equation here. It's a false equivalency. There's a lot of people that are very concerned with the police reaction or lack of reaction to what happened in Charlottesville, contrasting it with the police overreaction in Ferguson.
Idelson stressed the important role that workers and labor organizations have to play in opposing racism.
Opposition to racism, whether it's from the Nazis or police brutality or attacks on immigrants in this country, has to be a part of the movement for social change because they're connected. They'll always be connected. There was always a direct connection between the perpetuation of racism and the attacks on working people. You can't really ever separate them. It's critical. You can't have a movement without addressing both the racism and the class oppression that exists in this country today. It's important that people speak out about this at this time. It's not a time to be silent. It's not a time for moral equivalencies. This is a very dangerous time in America, and people need to take a stand and be heard.
WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. Online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now, from the Rick Smith Show and the Illinois Labor History Society, it's today's Labor History in 2 minutes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health." He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Now from our friends at H2O Radio, it's the Week in Water.
States challenge Native Americans' claims to groundwater. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
there is a water case so significant that last week 10 states, from Nevada to Texas, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review it.
A federal appeals court recently ruled that the Agua Caliente tribe has a right to groundwater dating back to the creation of their reservation in the 1870s.
That could mean that tribes have federally protected rights to surface and groundwater that would give Native Americans priority over rights created under state law.
The Desert Sun reports that the Agua Caliente tribe sued agencies in 2013, asserting that they had rights to groundwater under its reservation in Palm Springs, California, and the surrounding area.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, and if its ruling prevails, the case would set a powerful precedent for other tribes across the country, strengthening their claims to groundwater.
There's no guarantee that the High Court will take the case. However, it seems more likely because the U.S. Supreme Court has never been asked to rule on Native American claims to similar water rights.
While attention has been focused on the rhetoric between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, a dire humanitarian crisis is facing the people of Kim's country: drought and famine.
The United Nations warned late last month that the lack of rain could be the worst for the country since 2001. This year, a severe dry spell hampered the planting season for rice and cereal-producing provinces.
Famine due to drought is not new in North Korea. CNN reports from 1995 to 1999, about 2 to 3 million people died from hunger.
In 2016, the UN said that about 40% of the North Korean population was malnourished. Now the UN Food and Agriculture Organization is calling for other countries to donate more food. But the likelihood of that is not great, given the international community's inclination for increased sanctions.
Scott Pruitt, head of the EPA, is dismantling the agency by closing offices, eliminating staff, and rolling back regulations. And he's doing so as secretly as he can.
Interviews conducted by the New York Times of 20 current and former EPA employees reveal that Pruitt takes extraordinary steps to run the agency behind closed doors. Literally.
Some told the Times that doors to the floor with Pruitt's offices are locked, and employees must have an escort to gain entrance. Some are also told not to bring cell phones to meetings and not to take notes. Pruitt has armed security with him 24/7 and sometimes makes important calls not from his own office, but elsewhere.
An example of the stealth of Pruitt's method in rolling back rules is how the agency has reset the definition of the waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act. Staffers were told to eliminate an assessment by the Obama administration's proposed rule that showed favorable economic results.
A report was then prepared saying that there was no economic benefit to preserving wetlands, when the earlier version showed a benefit of nearly $600 million. The process to change the analysis was done overnight without the usual examination that can take up to months or even years.
Pruitt's secrecy has recently drawn a lawsuit. The state of California is suing the agency because it allegedly failed to comply with a request for documents that might indicate whether Pruitt has conflicts of interest.
The suit is aimed at stopping Pruitt from being involved in rolling back rules over which he sued EPA while Oklahoma's attorney general. An EPA spokesperson denied the allegations.
Wildfires across the U.S. have burned almost 6 million acres, which is nearly 2 million more than the average.
Smoke from the fires has spread east across the country. Conditions were so bad in Montana that the people of the town of Sealy Lake were advised to leave, or at least find somewhere else to sleep, due to the smoke.
Fires have also been burning in Canada, Italy, Romania, Russia, and other parts of Europe, and even in Greenland, an island covered mostly in ice.
According to Wildfire Today, thousands of acres of permafrost are being charred, releasing carbon as they burn.
This news about wildfires comes as NOAA recently released data showing that the first half of this year was the second warmest ever for the planet, and that the month of June was the third hottest.
In Europe, a record-breaking heat heat wave has been dubbed Lucifer. And the New York Times reports that in parts of Asia, including Pakistan, new high temperature records have people comparing it to living in hell.
High temperatures also struck the American Northwest and Southwest. Think Progress reports that based upon 20 studies, extreme heat is one of the signature characteristics of global climate change.
In other words, the hotter the world is, the greater chance that a heat wave will bring extreme temperatures.
And finally, seems like climate change has a sense of humor. Last week, a floating art installation designed to raise awareness about rising waters sunk during a severe storm.
An environmental art project called Wetland, that looks like a partially submerged home, was inspired by images of houses flooded during Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy.
But last weekend, the artwork that's built on a houseboat collapsed after it took on water from heavy rain and was pummeled by debris floating down the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia.
Ironically, the artist Mary Mattingly had created the work as a commentary on climate change. According to WHYY, the installation included solutions like solar panels as well as a water garden that might help coastal residents adapt to environmental damage.
The Philadelphia Inquirer reports that the plan is to lift the boat from the river bottom and tow it to a location to assess the damage. That undertaking could cost thousands of dollars, and it's not clear who will ultimately foot the bill for removal, but it's fair to say it won't be cheap.
But neither is the adaptation to climate change, and perhaps that's the biggest takeaway from the artwork's message.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Discuss your water infrastructure challenges and solutions at WIC 17, October 30th through November 2nd. Find out more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you covered a local event and have audio or video that you'd want to share with the KBOO audience, we want to hear from you. Call us at 503-231-8032, or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zare, Ken Jones, Fox, and Dagan McSwain. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Look at last week's events, including Trump threatening nuclear war and white supremacists threatening civil war. At 9, in alternative radio, Professor Michael Eric Dyson unpacks the invisible knapsack of white privilege. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D. May Roberts talks to best-selling author Jamie Ford about his newest novel, Love and Other Consolation Prizes. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews artists Drew Carson and Kate Simmons about their latest projects, Combat Paper and Slow Cooked. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we could use your help, guys. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
House Bill 2355 passed both houses of the Oregon legislature at the end of its season this year. The bill was introduced at the request of Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and attempts to tackle racial profiling. To learn more about the bill, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke earlier today with Kimberly McCullough, Policy Director at the ACLU of Oregon.
To talk to you about House Bill 2355, which passed the Oregon legislature. I didn't look today to see, but as far as I know, Governor Brown hadn't yet signed. It'll go into effect whether she signs it or not. So,
right. Yeah. I don't know exactly when the date will be. I know that she's been signing a bunch of bills this week and last week, and we anticipate that she will sign it. She has been very supportive of the legislation. So,
right on. And HB 2355 is interesting to me because it hits two different areas.
That's right.
If I could get you to talk first about one's racial profiling, one is a defelonization, a sort of what I would call a partial decriminalizing of simple personal use amounts, possession offenses for first offenders. So could you talk first about... And let's talk about the different parts first, the racial profiling first.
Absolutely. So the racial profiling aspect of the bill does a number of things. The first is it requires mandatory statewide training for every law enforcement officer. So that's going to be all officers as they get certified. Officers who are already certified are going to have to go through this training now. And then when officers go into supervisory positions, there's going to be another level of training that is going to be specifically addressed at reducing racial profiling and other types of profiling, because this bill actually prohibits profiling based on membership in a variety of different groups. So right now, that training is, they do have some anti-bias training, but it's an elective. So as you can imagine, the people who take it are the ones who maybe don't need it as much. And so this will be mandatory. It's also going to be an updated training. The training that they're using right now is really old, and it's like 30 years old and really out of date. It kind of dances around the issue instead of addressing it head on. And so there's going to be a whole new training created. The other thing it's going to do is it's going to require collection of data to so that we can understand who is it that law enforcement is stopping and citing and arresting. So that's going to include traffic stops, but it's also going to include pedestrian stops where there's a citation, a search, or an arrest. And that data is not going to be, you know, it's not going to identify the person who was stopped, but they'll collect the demographic data.
The state of Oregon has had a problem with that for a while. The Stanford, there's a Stanford project looking at police stops. The state of Oregon's data was some of the worst in the country. I mean, mm-hmm. They had something, but not much. When I've tried looking at arrests, one of the problems has been that ethnicity, a Latin American, Latino or Latina mm-hmm. ethnicity, wasn't being collected. Instead, they're just called white.
Right.
So does this actually... Will that resolve these problems?
Yeah, there's a whole set of data points that are going to need to be collected. It's going to be standardized across the state, and it's going to include a ton of different data points. And I know that trying to make sure that they accurately capture, it's not actually the race or ethnicity of the person as they self-identify, but it's what the officer thinks, right? Because that's where the profiling occurs. It's in their perception, and they're acting on that perception. But they're going to do a lot of work in figuring out these data points and how they train the officers to try to make sure that that data is as accurate as possible. But you're right that there are problems there. And then I should have mentioned that the data will be analyzed by the Criminal Justice Commission. They're going to run a bunch of different analyses on it to try to determine where profiling is occurring, how it's occurring. And when they identify disparities, that data then is going to be there'll be basically a collaborative process between the police department, the Department of Public Safety and Standards Training, the local public safety coordinating council, potentially their city council, their county commission, and the department itself to try to figure out what's actually happening here and how can we address it. And the legislature is going to keep track of that. And then we're also going to have community groups that are involved in that process.
So there will be the reporting too.
Yes, absolutely. And then there'll be a whole follow-up process. And, you know, we designed the system so that it's a collaborative process, so that we try to figure out what's going on, how do we address it. But we don't know how that part is actually going to play out until it happens. So there may be tweaks that we need to make to the process. There may be additional laws we need to pass to really make sure that we're addressing profiling when it happens. But the data is so crucial to moving the conversation forward.
Now let's go to the second half, really, of this bill. That is the defelonization. Tell me about this defelonization.
Yeah, absolutely. So I participated in the task force that actually basically made the recommendation to the legislature about what would be in this bill. And when we were discussing profiling, we just kept coming back to the drug war. And it's because the drug war and profiling are really, like, they're very intertwined. We know that, so much of the disparities, the racial disparities that happen with who gets searched or who gets stopped, that's really, it's driven in large part by, you know, officers trying to find contraband, trying to find drugs. And so this desire to try to enforce drug laws through, through police contact, it really drives so much of our disparities. And then the fact that we have these harsh penalties, it amplifies the result of those disparities. So, you know, even though we know that people of all races use drugs at approximately the same rates, we have, it's like 2.4, Black people are in the state of Oregon are 2.4 times more likely to actually get a drug possession charge. And Native American people, it's 5 to 1. To white people, which is just appalling. So we know, right, that drug possession and the enforcement is clearly intertwined with racial profiling. So we really wanted to address that by just getting to the heart of it and reducing those penalties. You mentioned that you see it as sort of a partial decriminalization. Yeah, I see it as a step towards decriminalization. Drug use and drug abuse should not be a criminal justice issue. So we see at least moving it from a felony to a misdemeanor is a step in the right direction.
Now, some folks raised the concern that this would make it less likely that people going into the system would then opt for drug court so that they could be put into treatment and then violated and then go into jail because they'd violated their probation. Do you think that's a legitimate concern? Do you think drug, I mean, I you don't have to tell me what you think about drug court, but do you think, or you could if you'd like, but do you think that's a legit concern?
So there's a couple of things to unpack there. One is drug court and what their function is. And the truth of the matter is that drug court is actually not designed to address drug possession. Drug court is supposed to be there to address folks who are committing additional crimes because of their drug use. So they may have drug and property crimes combined and so on. So that's really not, you know, drug courts really don't actually play into the drug possession conversation. But even if they did, we made sure when we wrote this law that that drug possession would still stay in the circuit courts. So if there are counties that want to push these cases into their drug court, they still will be allowed to do that. It won't go to municipal court like a lot of misdemeanors do. So the other thing that they brought up was, oh, well, this is going to, you know, that opponents brought up, and particularly some district attorneys, was, oh, well, this is going to reduce funding for community corrections and for the treatment that's available to folks. We also specifically wrote the bill so that community corrections and the drug treatment programs that they run are going to get the same amount of money that they were getting for them being a felony, for them being a misdemeanor. So that funding is not going away. But there's another sort of like more crucial thing here, which is the idea that people need coercion in order to get off drugs, right? It that doesn't make sense. If it made sense, then the drug war would have worked, and it didn't. We all know it's an abysmal failure. And the truth of the matter is that people who are struggling with drug addiction, often they've had trauma in their life, childhood abuse, abusive relationships, institutional trauma, all sorts of things, right? So coercion, the idea that you're going to coerce someone and you're going to traumatize them more, and that's going to help them, is just, it just doesn't make sense. Folks with drug addiction issues need help, And they need us to help them arrive at a place where they have the support and the help that they need to be able to actually get off of drugs. And that's just not, it's not a coercive, it's not a coercive thing. If you talk to drug treatment counselors, I mean, they get that.
If you could speak to me a little more about the reasoning behind having both of these different elements in the same bill.
Yeah, I mean, we just really felt like we couldn't address profiling without also addressing drug, the war on drugs. And so we really wanted to marry these ideas together because we wanted to actually emphasize the fact that they're absolutely intertwined. And we wanted to just have a very, very tangible way to reduce the impact of profiling and to also potentially reduce the motivation for profiling. And I think that it's sort of like one beginning example of what we hope to see come out of this whole process of the data and the data analysis is identifying more and more policies and more ways that law enforcement is interacting with the public that are exacerbating profiling. And so hopefully we're going to find more things, right, through this data. We know that there are practices like stop and frisk where there's, obviously large disparities. Also, just broken windows policing pulling over every person who has a broken taillight, pulling over every single person. There are all of these different ways that law enforcement engage with the public that really amplify profiling. And so, this drug piece was just us identifying one obvious example and trying to address that.
And we're running up close to the end of this segment. So could I get from you any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that folks should feel really positive about the fact that we passed this bill. It's a credit to the fact that, our attorney general and folks in the legislature, that they listened to the community and listened to the fact that we thought that this was such an important issue and that we needed to address it. And I do want to give credit to our law enforcement partners who actually came to the table and worked with us, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association. They worked really hard to get where they could, to move so that they could actually support the policy that we were putting forward. And they did support it, which is incredible to me. And so I think we should feel really positive about it. But we should also know that this problem is not just going to go away overnight, right? That this is an ongoing issue that we're going to have to stay vigilant and we're going to have to stay involved and we're going to have to keep our eye on the ball and keep coming up with new ways to address this issue. Profiling is so complex and bias is so complex. And our society, racism is institutional and it is not easy to solve. And so we're really going to have to stay involved. And I hope that folks in the community will continue to raise their voices.
Well, and they should know how to find Oregon ACLU just in case they have concerns or just want to get involved. Where do they find you on the web? What kind of social media stuff? And do you have volunteers and such, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook page, ACLU of Oregon. We're also on Twitter as ACLU of Oregon. We have a website, ACLU-OR.org. You can sign up there. You can become a member, which we really appreciate and definitely helps us in our advocacy. You can sign up for our action alerts where we ask you guys to send, letters to your legislator, things like that. We do have lobby days where folks can come to the Capitol with me and I train them on how to talk to their legislators and how to advocate on certain issues. And they actually get to meet with them, which is super exciting. It's very empowering for folks. We do have some limited volunteer positions in our office, but we're actually really small. I think folks often think of the ACLU and they think we're huge, but we have, I think, let's see here, do we have 11 employees now at our office here in Portland? So we're growing a bit, but we're still pretty tiny. But we do have a new statewide organizer, so I know that she's, trying to find ways to plug folks into some more sort of on-the-ground advocacy. There's a lot of interest in helping us right now, and so, and we're so appreciative of that, but it takes some time to try to figure out how to plug folks in. So I think the action alerts, signing up for our mailing list, coming to our events, and then just really educating yourself about the issues. We have a lot of information that we put up online and blogs and so on. So I think really diving in and learning the issues is really a huge first step.
Okay. And then you can do all that at aclu-or.org. That's terrific. What's your title?
Policy Director.
Thank you. This is where I earn my stripes editing. Let's not do that. Barking into the phone. I've been speaking with Kimberly McCullough. She's the Policy Director at the ACLU of Oregon. We've been talking about HB 2355, a bill which passed the Oregon legislature on racial profiling as well as drug penalties. And Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, the only program of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington. I'm Stephen Siegel, and I'm here with my co-host, Chris Reiser.
Hey, Good Chris. Evening.
Hey. Also sitting in with us today is Brian Chu. Brian teaches, he's a member of Portland Association of Teachers. I'll let him tell you a little bit more about himself.
Yeah, what do you,